You know, the end of 2023, it really hit home when that single bottle of McAllen Valerio Dami 60-year-old sold. I mean, a stunning $2.7 million.
Wow. Yeah.
That's not just a drink, is it? It's become this global phenomenon.
Absolutely.
And it really underlines why we're taking a deep dive today into something truly fascinating. Fine whiskey as an alternative investment.
Mm-hmm.
We're looking at a market that's, you know, constantly evolving beyond the usual traditional assets, especially as we look ahead to 2025.
Right. And our mission today really is to give you a shortcut, a way to understand this pretty unique asset class.
Okay.
We'll get into its history, which is quite dynamic, demystify some of the essential language.
Yeah, the jargon can be tricky.
It can. And we'll break down some effective investment strategies and maybe peek into what the future might hold.
Sure.
The aim is to equip you with clear insights to navigate it wisely.
Offering different perspectives, those aha moments, but without, you know, drowning everyone in data.
Exactly. No information overload.
Okay, so before we dive too deep, let's just make sure we're all on the same page, language-wise.
Good idea.
There's this fundamental difference, just a single letter, when we talk about this golden spirit, and it actually tells us quite a bit about its origin.
It really does. What's crucial to know is the whiskey versus whiskey distinction. Spelled W-H-I-S-K-Y, whiskey, that typically refers to spirits from Scotland, Japan, and Canada. Think classic Scotch.
Right. The traditional big names.
Exactly. Then whiskey, with the E, that denotes products from Ireland and the U.S. So that includes popular types like bourbon, Tennessee, and rye whiskeys.
And historically, the really eye-watering prices often come from Scottish or Japanese distillers, right?
Generally, yes.
Yeah.
But you shouldn't discount Irish and U.S. variants. They can still yield pretty significant returns, absolutely.
Okay, so you've picked your spelling preference, maybe your region. Then you've got two main ways to actually invest. Individual bottles or entire casks.
Mm-hmm.
What are the key considerations there? It sounds like a big difference.
It is, and it presents a really important choice for investors. Investing in casks is often seen as more of a longer-term play.
Right, letting it mature.
Precisely. And here's a fascinating advantage. Casks are classified as wasting assets.
Wasting assets? What does that mean exactly?
It means they have a natural lifespan, roughly 50 years or less, because, you know, evaporation, interaction with the wood.
The angel's share.
Exactly, the angel's share. And because of that classification, they are therefore exempt from capital gains tax in certain jurisdictions like the UK.
Oh, wow. That's huge.
That's a major point. Bottles, on the other hand, can last pretty much indefinitely if stored properly. And so they're subject to capital gains tax on sales above a certain threshold, like £6,000 in the UK.
So that tax difference alone could seriously shape your whole investment strategy.
Absolutely. Long-term versus potentially quicker but taxable gains.
Okay, and just to make sure everyone's fluent in the essential lingo, let's run through a few other quick terms you might hear. A cask, obviously. The wooden barrel for maturation. Single malt means it's from one type of malted grain, usually barley. All at a single distillery.
The classic definition.
A blended malt combines single malts, but from various distilleries. Malt whiskey is made exclusively from malted barley.
Mm-hmm.
New make spirit, that's the clear, potent stuff before it goes into the cask. Basically pre-whiskey.
The raw potential.
And single cask malts are just what they sound like, bottled from one specific cask. So they often have a very unique character.
Very sought after for that reason.
Okay, now we've got that foundation. Let's look at how this whole market has actually evolved over time. It sounds like quite a ride.
Oh, it is. The history of fine whiskey as an investment, it's almost a classic boom and bust story, really. And that created the market paradoxes we see today.
So what were those early dynamics like, say back in the 60s, 70s, 80s?
Well, it's quite the journey. That period, the 1960s to 1980s, saw this initial boom. You had Scottish brands like Glenfiddich and Macallan really pushing out globally, marketing outside Scotland for the first time seriously.
Creating that demand.
Exactly. But this rapid growth, it led to some quality issues and, crucially, an oversupplied market. A glut.
Too much whiskey. Sounds like a good problem, but maybe not for distillers.
Not for them, no. Many distilleries, even some well-known ones like Ardbeg and Springbank, actually face temporary closures.
Mm.
But here's the ironic twist.
Uh-huh.
All this glut of unsold whiskey, it was simply allowed to sit there and age in casks. Inadvertently, it became the highly sought-after, beautifully aged classics of the future.
Wow, so the problem became the treasure.
Pretty much. And during this time, we also saw Japanese distilleries starting up, often inspired by and mimicking Scottish techniques.
So moving into the 90s then, that must have been a tough time with all that oversupply and, I guess, a market that wasn't really liquid.
Extremely tough.
Yeah.
Very illiquid. And I've heard those stories too. A cask of Macallan, a really good one, could be picked up for as little as, say, £3,000 back then. And that's where the real lesson in patience comes in. Because those same types of older Macallan casks, they can now command as much as £300,000. Maybe more.
£300,000 from three?
Yep. It perfectly illustrates that the best whiskey investments, they aren't quick flips. They really demand a long-term view.
You need patience.
You really do. Then you fast forward to the 2000s and things start to shift. The internet really started to open things up.
Accessibility.
Exactly. Online retailers suddenly made things like single cask malts much more accessible to people outside the sort of traditional circles. And we saw early signs of a collector's market starting to bubble up, like Dalmore setting a world record back in 2002, £25,000 for a bottle. Seemed huge then.
Peanuts compared to today, but a sign of things to come.
A definite sign.
Okay, so this period, let's say the 2010s up to now, 2025, this seems to be where all those earlier market dynamics really converged and, well, exploded.
Absolutely. That's the perfect word. We saw an explosion of online auctions, specialist retailers. And critically, those undervalued casks from the 70s and 80s finally reached peak maturity.
The treasure chests were open.
They were. And this period delivered just incredible returns. Some whiskey investments were seeing multiples of 30, even 40x in just a decade.
Wow.
Macallan really solidified its position as the ultra-luxury brand. Records were just repeatedly shattered year after year, culminating, as you said, in that staggering $2.7 million sale late last year.
So after that whirlwind history tour, what can we sort of take away about the market's current state? It's clearly dynamic. Players shift, like Japanese whiskey rising, Macallan maybe overtaking Dalmore.
Yeah, it's definitely dynamic. And while whiskey trends tend to move a bit slower than, say, the S&P 500,
right,
it's certainly not without its volatility. You look at the COVID-19 pandemic, for instance. That sparked a massive surge in interest, and prices spiked quite dramatically for a while.
So what does that tell us?
Well, it tells us that while the past performance has been pretty exceptional, there are absolutely no guarantees for the future. You really need to approach it with your eyes wide open to the potential ups and downs.
And I guess many potential investors are still lured by those incredible stories of, you know, 400% to 500% returns from the past decade or so.
Of course, they're compelling stories.
But should we maybe temper those expectations a bit looking towards 2025 and beyond?
I think that's wise, yes, precisely. The market has become much, much more efficient. There's just more information out there, more investors involved.
Okay.
So while the right bottles, carefully chosen, can still potentially achieve respectable, say, 12% to 15% annual growth.
Which is still very good.
Absolutely. Very strong returns. But those astronomical multi-100% returns of yesteryear, they might well be historical. You could argue much of that explosive growth potential is already kind of baked into current prices for many well-known bottles.
Which makes doing your homework even more crucial now.
More important than ever.
You mentioned earlier that taste, surprisingly, isn't always the primary driver of value for collectors. That's interesting.
It is, isn't it?
So for someone looking to invest, what truly makes one bottle a winner and maybe another just sits on the shelf? What should you actually be looking for?
Yeah, what's fascinating here is that while taste undeniably improves with age, generally speaking.
You'd hope so.
It would, but it's rarely the most important factor in the final price of a really collectible whiskey. Branding plays a massive, massive role.
The name, the reputation.
Exactly. The perception of quality, the distillery's reputation, its legacy. Then the year it was made and bottled is critical. And of course, genuine scarcity, you know, properly limited editions.
Not just limited labels slapped on everything.
Precisely. Actual verifiable rarity. And intriguingly, there's even some data suggesting that the presence of a well-regarded distillery visitor center seems to bolster a brand's public perception and potentially its secondary market price.
Huh. That's a quirky detail.
It is. So, boiling it down, for a potentially high-value bottle, you might look for something from a much-loved or maybe even a vaulted closed distillery.
Ah, the silent stills.
Yes. Ideally, it should be an official distillery release, not an independent bottling. Maybe from a discontinued series, aged well, say, 12 years plus, and genuinely limited in number.
Got it. So this modern whiskey market, let's say stuff released in the last 10, 15 years, you're saying it operates a bit differently from the vintage market?
Yes, I think it does.
Most releases are still obviously meant for drinking, but this new investment perception means many limited runs just get snapped up by collectors, not actually consumed.
Exactly. And that has consequences.
What does that mean for today's investor then?
Well, it means the distilleries are keenly aware of this secondary market. They're not naive,
Right.
so they price their rare and limited runs, well, appropriately, right from the outset.
Yeah.
They capture a lot of that potential value themselves.
So less room for massive jumps later.
Potentially, yes. And coupled with the fact that, as you said, these bottles often aren't being consumed and removed from the market, there can actually be quite an ample supply floating around on the secondary market, even for limited editions.
Ah, okay.
This makes that kind of explosive, unforeseen price acceleration we saw with older, genuinely rarer bottles less likely for many modern releases. You're probably looking at more steady, predictable growth if you choose well.
So while these modern collector's releases might seem appealing, maybe lower entry prices sometimes, they come with their own set of challenges.
They absolutely do. The initial outlay, as I said, can still be pretty high because the distillery prices it accordingly. And a limited edition might not feel truly scarce if thousands of bottles are all being held by collectors rather than being drunk. Sourcing often involves these ballot
The
systems,
lottery draw.
basically, yeah, which requires luck more than skill sometimes.
Yeah.
And as we discussed, if loads of bottles are bought purely as collectibles, the secondary market can get saturated pretty quickly.
All right.
This can lead to softer prices than maybe eager flippers might hope for when they try to sell.
Right. The quick buck isn't always there.
Not always, no.
All right. So let's say someone listening is intrigued. They understand the history, the lingo, the dynamics. Now, how do you actually get started? What are the pathways to acquiring investment whiskey?
Okay, good question. Broadly, you can think about it in two main ways: direct ownership of the physical whiskey or indirect exposure to the market.
Okay, let's start with direct ownership. Bottles or casks?
Right. For direct ownership, you've got a few main routes.
Obvious one. Convenient, fixed prices, you know what you're getting. But often higher markup, sometimes significantly, and you'll likely have less access to the really old or genuinely rare stuff.
Your local shop might not have that 50-year-old rarity.
Probably not. Second, direct from the distillery. This can be great. Potentially excellent prices, perfect provenance, ideal storage history. But as we mentioned, it often involves those competitive ballot systems for the desirable releases.
So look at the draw again.
Often, yes. Third, auction houses. Places like Sotheby's, Christie's, or specialist whiskey auction sites. Here you get access to incredibly diverse, rare, sometimes obscure whiskeys. And depending on jurisdiction, there might be no VAT.
Sounds good, but what's the catch?
The downsides are unpredictable prices. Auction fever is real. Plus, high auction fees, buyer's premium, seller's commission, which can be 10% to 25% each, and fierce competition for the best lots.
Okay. What else for direct?
Fourth is private sale, often facilitated via a broker. This gives access to items not widely available on the open market. Again, potentially no VAT, but it really relies on having a good, trusted broker network. Brokers charge fees too, maybe 10-15%, and you're often buying from savvy sellers who know the value.
Right, you need good connections there. Now, what about indirect exposure?
Two main ways here. First, whiskey stocks. Investing in the shares of publicly traded companies that own distilleries, think big players like Diageo, Pernod Ricard, Brown-Forman.
So you're betting on the industry's overall popularity.
Exactly. But you lack that direct ownership prestige, the tangible asset. And importantly, you need to research the company, not just the whiskey market. It's worth noting that each of those big companies had a pretty rough 2023 stock-wise, so their performance isn't solely tied to whiskey prices.
Good point. Diversification within those companies matters. And the second, indirect way.
Whiskey investment funds. These pool investor money to buy and manage a portfolio of whiskeys. They offer exposure without you having to handle storage or sourcing, and they're managed by supposed experts.
What, there's always a but.
But the quality varies enormously. Fees can be high, transparency might be limited, and you really need to do thorough due diligence on the fund manager, their track record, their strategy, and the underlying assets. It's not a passive investment in that sense.
Lots of options, each with pros and cons. Now, you mentioned ballots. It's interesting how something designed to be democratic, like a distillery ballot, can be so influenced by technology these days.
Oh, absolutely. It's a double-edged sword, isn't it? On one hand, ballots are often a very clever marketing tool for the distilleries. They create buzz, imply higher demand, exclusivity.
Makes people want it more.
Exactly. But then you have the issue of bots, these automated programs that people can use to snap up bottles instantly or enter ballots hundreds, even thousands of times.
Oh, gaming the system.
Totally. This artificially inflates the perceived demand. And then when the flippers who use bots try to offload those bottles quickly onto the secondary market,
the price might not hold up.
It can lead to softer secondary market prices than you'd expect, precisely because the initial demand wasn't entirely real. It creates this sort of illusion of scarcity that isn't quite accurate for that specific release.
Fascinating. Okay, another question that comes up. Collections. Are they always worth more than the sum of their individual bottles?
Yeah.
Say, getting that whole Game of Thrones set you mentioned earlier.
Generally speaking, yes. A complete collection of a rare or limited whiskey series can often command a premium over the total value of its individual bottles if sold separately. People pay for completeness.
Okay.
However, it's also important to remember that finding a buyer for an entire, often expensive collection can sometimes take longer. It might be a less liquid asset compared to selling individual high-demand bottles. Swings and roundabouts.
Makes sense. Now, we've focused quite heavily on scotch, understandably. But what about bourbon? Can that be a strong investment avenue for someone?
Bourbon is a really fascinating niche, absolutely. It's primarily U.S.-made, of course, and its popularity has been soaring, especially within North America, but increasingly globally, too.
So similar trends to scotch.
Very much so. It's followed a pretty similar upward trajectory to the broader whiskey investment market over the last decade or so. We've seen standout sales, like a bottle fetching, I think, $100,000 at auction back in 2021.
Wow.
And data on select bourbon casks has shown an average return somewhere around 13.8% annually in recent periods. So definitely potential there.
But is there a specific warning for bourbon, especially new releases?
Yes, there's a pattern worth noting. With hyped new bourbon releases, collectors and investors can sometimes panic buy on the secondary market, driving prices up very quickly.
FOMO, fear of missing out.
Big time. But once that initial frenzy, that demand is sated, prices can drop back down surprisingly fast. We've seen drops of as much as 33% over just a couple of months after the peak.
Ouch. So timing and maybe resisting the initial hype is key there.
Restraint is definitely a virtue in that part of the market.
Okay, looking at the bigger picture now, the broader trends, What positive signs or tailwinds are potentially on the horizon for whiskey investment overall?
Well, I think there are three pretty significant factors that look positive. Firstly, developing countries.
Ah, the growth engine.
Exactly. The rising appreciation for whiskey, and importantly, the growing purchasing power in key Asian markets, think India, China, where whiskey is often seen as a potent status symbol. That's a huge demand driver.
Okay, number one.
Secondly, the potential impact of falling interest rates. If central banks do start cutting rates in 2025, as some economists predict, possibly even from Q2 onwards.
More cheap money floating around.
Potentially, yes. More capital could flow out of traditional savings and into alternative investments, including whiskey, as people look for hedges against inflation or simply better returns.
Makes sense. And the third factor.
Thirdly, and this is really interesting, a growing interest among younger generations. Millennials, in particular, seem to value authenticity, craft, unique experiences.
Things whiskey often represents.
Precisely. They're driving significant market growth. There are predictions the global whiskey market could hit something like $127 billion by 2028, with a compound annual growth rate over 6%. And you see tangible examples like South Korea's whiskey imports jumping 80% in 2023 alone. That shows real growing demand.
So demographics, economics, and global taste trends all potentially aligning.
It looks that way, yes.
Okay, we've covered a huge amount of ground. Let's try and distill this, pun intended, into some top tips for you, the listener, the potential investor, looking at 2025.
Good idea.
First off, I think it's crucial to reiterate. Remember that those stunning peaks we saw around, say, 2018, and those incredible accelerated growth numbers like 500x returns over decades, they're probably unlikely to be repeated across the board.
That's the number one reality check, I'd say. Focus on seeking potentially slow and steady returns. Be very, very wary of any whiskey fund or advisor promising the moon and the stars, you know, 40% guaranteed annual returns or something crazy.
If it sounds too good to be true.
It almost certainly is in today's more efficient market. Expect more modest, but hopefully still strong returns if you invest wisely.
Tip number two seems to be, go deep with your research. Context is absolutely everything.
Precisely. You gave that great example earlier. Remember that McAllen Red collection that sold for nearly $1 million at Sotheby's back in 2020?
Yeah.
A huge chunk of that final price was because the proceeds were going to charity. It drove bidding way up.
Feel good factor inflated the price.
Significantly. So if you see a similar collection listed somewhere else for, say, half that price, don't automatically assume it's an incredible bargain you have to snap up. You need to understand why that first one sold for so much.
Numbers are important, but the story behind the numbers is critical.
Couldn't have put it better myself. Context is everything.
Okay, third tip. Don't overlook cask investment. We touched on it earlier, but maybe just remind us of the unique potential there.
Absolutely. It's easy to focus on bottles because they're more visible. Mm. But holding a cask, say buying a good quality 10-year-old cask and holding it until it reaches 15 or even 20 years old, that is truly a long game investment.
Patience required again.
Definitely. But because of those potential tax advantages in some places, and the simple fact that the whiskey inside is continuing to mature and potentially increase in quality and rarity, that's often where the most significant profits can be made over time. It requires more capital upfront and management, but the upside can be higher.
Worth considering for the long haul. Finally, we know the highest returns often lie in the riskiest propositions.
That old maxim holds true here, too.
So talk about the riskiest end. New make spirits.
Right. This is investing in the spirit before it's legally whiskey. That clear liquid, the new make, straight off the still. It requires at least 3 years maturing in a cask before you can even call it whiskey.
And then probably many more years to be valuable.
Exactly. And there are just so many variables. You're betting on a new distillery, finding its feet, developing a good reputation, managing its wood policy well, the spirit actually maturing nicely. There's a lot of risk associated with these new players.
So high potential, but high risk.
Very much so. While the potential for high returns exists if you pick a winner early, I'd advise caution. Maybe limit your exposure to these newer, unproven players until they have more of a track record. Don't bet the farm on new make.
Sound advice. Okay, to give people some really tangible ideas, let's quickly spotlight just a few examples of the types of whiskeys mentioned in our sources that might be promising for 2025, illustrating some of these principles. Not investment advice, of course, just examples.
Of course. Well, we're seeing continued value in certain areas. For that exclusivity factor, you might look at something like the Glenlivet 1981 Whiskey Exchange Exclusive. It's got age, it's a limited release from a specific retailer, only 702 bottles, which adds scarcity, and its value is likely to increase steadily.
Okay, exclusivity. What else?
For cultural cachet, that Diageo Game of Thrones collection is interesting. The value is really in the complete set of 8 bottles. It connects to a hugely popular fan favorite series, and complete sets have apparently already tripled at auction in some cases. Shows the power of branding and theme.
Pop culture connection. Makes sense. What about a solid big name?
For reliable pedigree, something like the McAllen Rare Cask 2020 release could be considered a solid choice. It's from the big name, McAllen. They state only 1% of their maturing whiskey is deemed suitable for this series, implying quality control and rarity. It started around 225 pounds, offering a more accessible entry point to the brand.
Still McAllen, but maybe not six figures.
Exactly. Then you have the really serious investments like a McAllen Exceptional Single Cask 1950. We're talking maybe 69,000 pounds. Very limited, 336 bottles, matured for nearly 7 decades. That's top-tier collecting.
Right at the peak. Any slightly more unusual ones?
Well, something like the Johnny Walker Black Label Director's Cut Blade Runner 2049 whiskey. It's less scarce 39,000 bottles, but its special packaging linked to the film, and apparently a unique, smokier twist on Black Label makes it a compelling collectible, probably more of a long-term proposal based on its uniqueness.
Cool factor.
Yeah, the cool factor. And of course, there are those incredible older collections, like a full run of McAllen from 1954 or 1986, or single bottles like the McAllen Selected Reserve 1946, over 70 years old now. Mm-hmm. These are serious historical artifacts as much as drinks. The key theme across these is finding that blend of respected heritage, genuine scarcity, and some kind of unique appeal or story.
What an incredible deep dive. We've gone from million-dollar bottles to cask taxes to Game of Thrones. It's truly this amazing blend of history, complex market forces, and, let's be honest, sheer passion that makes whiskey investment such a captivating, if definitely complex, asset class.
It truly is, and I think if listeners take one thing away, it's that patience really is required to see the potential worth in many of these investments. And thorough research is absolutely your best ally. Don't just jump on the bandwagon.
Good advice.
You know, rarer whiskey investment in the grand scheme of things is still relatively young as a widespread phenomenon. So arguably, now could still be a very good time to invest strategically in what you understand, what you can afford, maybe take a few calculated smaller risks up front to see what works for you.
Learn by doing. Carefully.
Carefully, yes. And maybe this leaves us with a final thought. It raises an important question, doesn't it? In this era where seemingly so many everyday items can suddenly become collectible, what truly defines lasting value for something like whiskey?
Good question.
Is it purely the inherent quality in the liquid? Is it the carefully curated scarcity? Or is it something more intangible, just our collective imagination, our branding of something as essential as desirable?
A fantastic thought to leave everyone mulling over. Thank you so much for joining us and sharing all that insight on The Deep Dive.
My pleasure.
And thank you all for listening. Keep that curiosity alive, keep exploring, and we'll catch you next time.